You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Hello, I'm Peter Singer. I direct the 21st Century Defense Initiative here at Brookings, and I'm delighted to welcome all of you to the 2012 Military and Federal Fellow Research Symposium. Like a number of other think tanks and universities around the nation whose members will be represented at this symposium today, Brookings not only carries out its own research, but also hosts the Federal Executive Fellows Program, which is made up of officers and officials from all of the services and several government agencies. It was from this Military and Government Fellows Program that the concept of this symposium sprung several years ago. Those of us who were involved in hosting these programs saw how the officers involved weren't just serving as a valuable bridge between their home services and the policy and the academic worlds, but they were also conducting their own top-flight independent research on issues faced by the national security community. And it was because of the experience and expertise that they brought to the table that they were often focusing on important topics that were either under-researched or they were bringing new perspectives to old debates. That is, they were often bringing the best of both worlds to complex issues. And so this symposium series was created to provide a platform for that kind of research. The theme of this year's symposium is Present Meets Future, Evolving Defense Paradigms. And I think it shows very well the value of that kind of approach, of allowing officers to conduct independent research on what they believe will be emerging topic areas of importance. Today we're going to enjoy panel discussions on the latest research in areas like international engagement strategy, China's rising global influence, terrorism, counterinsurgency, and Department of Defense reforms. Now, what is striking is that while each one of these topics encompass core policy questions today, the fellows researching these topics decided to start on their journey almost 10 months ago. That is, those of us who work in both D.C. but also in academia can attest, it is all too rare to get the opportunity to discuss timely issues, but from the perspective of in-depth research. It's with that in mind that I have to emphasize for all of you, but particularly for the media joining us here today, that the research and the policy recommendations and statements made by those gathered here today are not about espousing official policy. Rather, it's a research symposium intended to provide a greater awareness of the research work that these leaders are producing on cutting-edge issues. Importantly, cutting-edge issues that both the research world but also the bureaucracy is finding a challenging time dealing with today. That's what makes it such an exciting event. And it's been an honor for those of us here at Brookings to see this program come together, and we very much appreciate all of you joining us today. And with that, I'm especially honored to welcome our opening speaker, who will help us set the scene for this event. Lieutenant General Christopher Miller's career very much exemplifies the diversity of experiences and expertise that we ask of our top officers in the U.S. military today. He entered Air Force service as a graduate of the Air Force Academy in 1980, subsequently earning a degree in international relations from Oxford. His staff assignments include two previous tours at Air Force Headquarters in International Affairs and as a policy advisor to the U.S. Ambassador to NATO. His operational assignments include two wing commands, serving as the senior Air Force commander in Afghanistan and command of America's only B-2 wing at Whiteman Air Force Base. He currently serves as Deputy Chief of Staff for Strategic Plans and Programs at Headquarters Air Force here in Washington. In this program, in this position, he leads the development and integration of the Air Force's long-range plans and the five-year, $635 billion Air Force Future Years Defense Program. General, we're delighted to welcome you here today.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you, Pete, for that kind introduction. It is a real pleasure to be here, and in a way, the title of this symposium is actually sort of what my job is, bringing the present and the future together with the near-term program. That's clearly something that we're living in the present, doing it every day, trying to make the best of the resources we have to meet the jobs that we are assigned as an Air Force and as a Department of Defense. And then you don't do that without looking out ahead to the future, which is sort of the other half of the job. So it's a real pleasure to be here and kind of talk about what's in my job jar, but really to focus on warming up the discussion for you, for the fellows who are going to present, and the group of folks who are here to talk about some important issues. There are a couple of things about DOD that I think make this a timely topic at any time, but particularly as we approach a transition point. One is, by nature, a big institution is difficult to change, and so when we're thinking about progressing into the future, little things done early can have a big effect, but they have to be done, and they have to be done intentionally. And second, DOD has another a disincentive to change, and that is we've been very successful for a long time, and so it's sometimes hard to break out of current-day constructs, current-day ways of thinking about the problem, and to move forward. And so if you're here as a fellow either presenting or with your fellow fellows, or if you're a young officer who's just getting ready to start down the road toward these kinds of things, I get some good news and some bad news for you. The bad news is, by virtue of being a fellow, you're a designated change agent. The worst news is sometimes being the tip of the spear means your first contact with things that are hard to change. But the good news is it means you have an opportunity to make a difference and to help take a bite out of some problems that are central to the future prosperity and survival of our nation. And I did not do my homework to figure out how to change slides, but I guess we got it figured out. So my perspective this morning as I open things up is going to be from an Air Force perspective, because that's the job I'm in right now. But I'll try to relate it to the larger DOD and national perspective where it's appropriate. If you kind of look at the evolution of our defense complex, and particularly the Air Force part of it since the end of the Second World War, we've gone through some very distinct phases. End of the war, containment and collective security was clearly one of them, things that we all know well because they've been in the vernacular for a long time. That was associated with the Cold War. And this line here is an interesting sort of way of capturing the relationship between technology and capability and the resources that it takes to field that technology, because that's the procurement for Air Force weapon systems over time. The number of platforms that we bought at particular eras as we go through this last half century plus. So the end of that inflection point, with the end of the Cold War, we sort of moved into an era of regional operations and stability. We, as an Air Force, focused on what we call global reach and global power. We saw technology bring us precision strike and integrate that into things like Desert Storm and post-Desert Storm operations. 9/11 brought us another inflection point into what we call overseas contingency operations, characterized by continuing nuclear deterrence, which has been a strategic theme throughout, but a great increase in our need to surveil the battle space, to understand what it is happening not only in the battle space, but in the wider world. Continued focus on building partnerships and outside of formal alliances, much more so than in the time previous. And so if you look at the time period we're approaching now, this is not a DOD term, this is my term, for what we are approaching now. We have been focused on the low end of the conflict spectrum. We have been continuing some pieces of the high end of the conflict spectrum. But we are now approaching a time where we're trying to rebalance the way we approach things. We're facing some challenges out here in terms of continuing to be able to operate in an anti-access area denial environment, continue to have high-end combat forces, but without losing the low-end capabilities we have. We need to continue to have the tools that have given us success over the last couple of decades. The importance of space and cyber is clear. We still need to be able to operate across the planet, and so right size lift is one of the components of this, all of which from an Air Force perspective, and we'll come back to this, adds up to global vigilance, reach, and power to do these sorts of things that are part of the evolving DOD strategy. This is a very busy chart. It's not my intent to walk through every single one of these things or to try to tell you that they are in priority order or that they're even necessarily all accurate. But I think it is accurate to say that globalization is a continuing trend. It will not slow down. It brings with it a proliferation of capabilities. It brings with it the visibility of and the existence of rising extremism, at least in the near term. Cyberspace, incredibly prevalent in most of the developed world, increasingly prevalent in the developing world. It is a domain and an area that we cannot afford not to think about a lot. If you look at the impact of demographics, increasing populations, increasing urbanization, manpower shortages that are in pockets throughout the world but nevertheless significant. You look at things like supply and demand, the U.S. role as a superpower changing over time, China as a strategic challenge and a strategic partner. Russia continuing to evolve, and I could go down the list on the left. Well, what does that imply for us? And you can kind of see the implications on the right, all of which, from a U.S. DOD standpoint, require us to relook some of the basic assumptions we have about how we prepare for war, how we prosecute and sustain peace, where we operate routinely, and so on. I think it's safe to say that not only are individual things on either side of this chart important, but one of the most difficult pieces of this is understanding which of those connecting lines makes a difference. And the research that you as fellows have been doing has a lot to do with what those connections are and what direction things are moving along those connections. As a programmer, I have to talk about resources for a couple of minutes. So I think it is important for us to remember that there are macroeconomic trends that will affect our careers, your careers, probably for as long as you're wearing a uniform for the military fellows. And they're different from what we've seen in the past. From 66 to 2016, all of this is based on OMB numbers. You can see the increase in mandatory, relatively constant, actually slightly decreasing non-defense expenditures, a decreasing percentage of federal outlays for national defense. But it's really pretty striking when you look at the percentage that we've devoted to defense as a graphic percentage, 66 at 44%, down to projected 15% in 2016. That affects the choices we can make. And it's seen most clearly here, where you can see the projection of the federal debt. And so while threat has always modulated the level of resources available to defense, there are constraints on that modulation that may change historical patterns somewhat. And when we look at historical patterns, it's interesting to note that defense outlays are cyclical. That is no surprise, and you can see it's related to the threats. This chart includes spending on operations, so in this particular case, it includes overseas contingency operation funding. The point I would make here is that we were on a path with the 12 budget to a 24% reduction. We are now about on this 29% reduction. A further reduction would still only bring us down to a historical average above the periodic low. But why that's still a concern has to do with this chart. And what this shows, I won't walk through it in a great deal of detail, but there are two conclusions that are important. One is operations and maintenance. What it costs us to do business has been growing as a percentage of what we spend on defense. The second is procurement, although it has not radically decreased, it is definitely less than it has been at many periods in our history as a service, while what we've spent to sort of grow our seed corn has been relatively constant. If you're thinking about the rise in personnel costs, this chart may surprise you a little bit because it shows military personnel spending as a percentage relatively level. However, what you have to remember is that end strength here was about twice what it is here. And so this economic picture this division of the pie is likely to be a feature of any solution that we think about for any military problem for a good while to come. Although, like Secretary Panetta says, fiscal security and national security do not have to be opposites of each other. One of the things that I think, regardless of your service, and this has got an Air Force symbol on it because I'm an Air Force guy, but the United States has thought globally about military presence and the use of military force to maintain peace and stability for a very long time. That is unlikely to change. How we do it, though, and the complexity of the environment we're operating in is, in fact, not decreasing. And if you look at the joint force missions that the Secretary of Defense just indicated in his January strategy are important to us, it's a pretty broad list of things, which I notice in your research topics you're touching on quite a few of these. Again, I'm not going to take the time to go through in detail each of these missions because we could spend a lot of time on every single one of them. What I think is important, though, is if you look at how they relate to each other, we are still operating over the full spectrum. We are still operating over the entire planet. But exactly how we do that within that decreasing resource pie that we talked about is really kind of the key issue of our day, I think, in some respects. And not only how we do it today, but most importantly, how we think about doing it into the future. When I look at aviation, space, and to a lesser extent, cyber-related programs, the timeline for developing a significant capability is in the decade-plus time frame. So things that we are thinking about now will not come to fruition until the mid-20s, most likely, which means that all of these missions and the capabilities that we need to do them, for the most part, we need to envision what those capabilities are today so that we can get the appropriate start or put the appropriate resources against the existing technologies and doctrines and capabilities. And that kind of goes back to what I was talking about with doctrine and people. DoD as a big organization, the business of keeping expertise, developing expertise, training people to think about problems in a way that allows them to solve them. We've seen over the last 10 years the development of a counterinsurgency capability across the services that we did not have when we started in Iraq and Afghanistan. Maintaining that expertise is not going to be easy. Neither is evolving it into the kinds of challenges that we'll have to apply those same people against in the future. So this is it's a pretty large set of challenges, and there's not yet, because of the nature of our defense requirements, a way to say we are not going to do many of the things that are there. So as I mentioned, from an Air Force perspective only, global vigilance, reach, and power. What does that mean? Global vigilance over the last 10 years, you've seen the building of numerous remotely piloted aircraft platforms to provide the kinds of ISR that we need in the environment we've been flying in. That is not necessarily transferable into the area of denial, anti-access environment. So how do we keep that capability? How do we keep the kind of capability that's let us put precise munitions against well-identified targets and translate that into a larger conflict, higher intensity conflict spectrum? How do we, in a world where the routine alliances are decreasing somewhat, how do we continue to have the throughput we need to get people to where they're going? And for us, the Air Force has divided up our job jar into about 12 core functions. I am not going to go through how all of these play together. What I am going to say is that the network of relationships between those core functions and what you can call a system of systems in getting to mission accomplishment in any particular task is critical. So, for example, global precision attack, doesn't happen unless you have the ISR to identify the targets, the command and control to put the assets against the targets. Does not happen unless you have the reach to get the platforms to where they need to operate from. All of that basically gets to we as an Air Force have to maintain superiority in airspace and cyber so that we can operate. And I know as I've looked at the topics that are going to be discussed today, there are a great number of looks at how do we become more agile? How do we, for example, keep our acquisition processes on track to stay even with this kind of a demand, to evolve the capabilities we have today against the evolving capabilities of tomorrow? So I would say, just as a way of warming up the discussion a little bit for you, some of the things that I think about as we go forward as an Air Force are on this list. We have seen a lot of evolution in our capabilities over the last 10 years to do counterinsurgency warfare, to do precise application of force, to do stability operations, to provide assistance through provincial reconstruction teams, those kinds of things. What of those lessons do we need to propagate? What things do we need to put on the shelf? What things do we need to decide were not profitable for us? We talk a lot about whole of government, about coalition operations. I would argue that those things happen because real people work with their peers in those organizations, build real relationships that allow those things to happen and allow systems that naturally will not necessarily jive to come together to accomplish common purposes. And I'll talk a little bit about that in just a minute. We need to look at how we connect operations and domains. For example, we talk about cross-domain capability, airspace, cyber, undersea, surface of the sea. The actual application of that cross-domain capability in a high-tech, speed-of-light world is a different kind of challenge from what it was in Vietnam, what it was in World War II, where communications were done by voice and planning was done by paper. So it is a conceptually different challenge when you look at, for example, in the F-35's case. People think of the F-35 as a low observable platform, and that as being one of its key characteristics. But I would argue that one of its other key characteristics is sensor capability and the ability to plug into a network. How do we leverage that? And not in grand strategic terms, but how do you make that operationally relevant across that joint and coalition team? How do we decrease what we call the OODA loop, the observe, orient, decide, and act loop? And that's an acquisition thing. It's a geostrategic thing. It's a training thing. Our world is moving faster, as you all well know because you're a part of it, and the agility of our processes will directly affect our ability to succeed. I would argue that we have rising expectations in the form of a very well-informed and very well-aware population across the world that is connected, and so we have seen a great increase in the standards of performance for the individual soldier, sailor, airman, and marine in conflict, and those standards require risk management, require a great deal of training, and how they play out in the low end of the conflict spectrum versus the high end of the conflict spectrum are likely to be two different things. So in a way, we have made it look easy for a long time, and propagating that in a world of advancing challenges is not going to be either easy or cheap. As I mentioned, we have the challenge of resource constraints, which may or may not work into a reduced level of resources for DOD in the future, but we have to be aware of, just like that aircraft procurement line that I showed you, regardless of how capable individual platforms become in the future, ships, aircraft, they can't be more than one place at one time. So our ability to engage with partners and allies, our ability to have routine presence is under downward pressure as we go forward. So what does that imply for our strategies? And finally, the shape of the force. We design our forces over time to meet the challenges we expect them to face. Deciding what those challenges are going to look like in 15 to 20 years and having the right mix of force prepared to go and take on those challenges may or may not change the shape of the force from what we see today. And that is an issue that we're all going to have to face as we go forward. And I think, you know, sort of my bottom line is the capability to be a force for good in the world that the U.S. Armed Forces have tried to be for a very long time, to be an influencer, to have capability to solve the problems that are out there, like assisting when Japan had an earthquake and a tsunami, like being able to engage in Libya. Those things are not a birthright. They're earned, and they're earned in an environment where the resources are under pressure and the challenges are increasing. And so, as I mentioned, as fellows, you have the privilege of taking a year to think about those things and to add a contribution to the body of knowledge. But not only what you're producing as fellows, as research, is important. The last thing I'd leave with you, and I believe this very firmly, again, this is an Air Force graphic. You could have the same thing for any service of any nation. But it boils down to the business we're in is fundamentally about people working together to do a mission. And it's not just people within the military services, which is why the fellowship is a uniquely valuable thing, because it gives you an opportunity to connect with your partners in thought. It gives you an opportunity to connect with a larger community outside the Department of Defense. We cannot be insular within any service or within the Department of Defense and do our jobs, because we are fundamentally connected to the people of this nation. And so this fellowship, I'm hoping that you've seen that as you've gone through the year, is really a tremendous opportunity for you to be that conduit and to contribute both internal to the defense debate and as a citizen and a representative. So I hope you'll continue to do that. I hope that the dialogue you have today as part of this symposium is outstanding. And when you go back to your service or to your organization, I hope that you'll take not only what you've been able to contribute as a fellow in research, but also the linkages that you will find as you go through the next 10, 15 years or however long you stay in your organization. You'll find those connections to be incredibly important in solving the problems that we cannot envision right now. So with that, I hope this has been a useful warm-up to you as you get ready to go, and I look forward to taking a couple questions.
So we've got time for a couple of questions. Wait for the mic to come. Stand, please identify yourself. And one last reminder, questions end with a question mark. So please raise your hand if you want to ask a question. Right there.
General, there's talk about a new stealth bomber.
Can you introduce yourself?
Oh, Hugh Grindstaff, THIS for diplomats. There's talk about a new stealth bomber, the possibility?
Yes. Secretary of Defense last year decided that the nation needed a new bomber, and his direction was that we would press on to develop that. It's on the kind of timeline that I mentioned. It's a decade or so. And we have direction to move out with that and to do it as efficiently as we can with some particular parameters that the Secretary gave us.
Thank you. Peter Humphrey, I'm an intelligence analyst. Can you shed some light on the Global Hawk diminution? Is it that our satellite systems and lower elevation drones are just so good that we no longer need Global Hawk, or what's going on there?
No, we had three key factors that played into the Global Hawk decision. One was the aggregate amount of high altitude ISR that the joint team needed to have changed from the time that the Global Hawk was initially put into production to augment and then replace the U-2. The second aspect was the U-2 has capability that is still more than adequate to do the job we need. And third, when $487 billion comes out of DOD's top line over the FYDP, we had to make some very difficult choices about things that we could and could not keep. And so in general, if we had the capability to do the job we needed and could do that less expensively, we chose for the less expensive option.
Did they get mothballed or scrapped or what happened?
That's still being decided.
Stanley Kober. Clausewitz defined war as the continuation of politics by other means. In Libya, we used military force, but did we achieve a political objective? We created a political space, but did we acquire any influence to affect the shaping of that political space? If not, are we fulfilling that definition of war?
Sir, that's a great question. What I would tell you, though, and it's not to evade the question, but from our perspective, as military professionals, we're the instrument. We're not the policy makers. Our job, and really one of the things I was trying to portray, is that when we're thinking about preparing a force to fight over the timetable that we have to think about, we have to be prepared not only to do those kinds of operations or to do the counterinsurgency operation or to fight a high-intensity war with a state actor. We have to be prepared to do it in combination with other things. And so I think what I would say is the instrument did what was asked of it, and the political and sort of macro considerations that follow is not in my job jar.
Okay, we've got time for one last question before the next minute. Right here.
Thank you, General. Ricardo Marquez, GAO. To dovetail with the question on Global Hawk, mm-hmm. can you describe some of your efforts to collaborate with the Navy, perhaps on decisions that you make in the Air Force with resources and programs? Global Hawk and Air Force impacts what the Navy is going to be doing. Does the Air Sea Battle Office set a precedent for cooperation? How deep will it go?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it gets to something that I didn't have time to talk about. But there are a couple of important things. There is cooperation and collaboration on the operational level that drives a lot of things. Air Sea Battle and the intent of the Air Force and the Navy as part of a larger joint operational access concept to do at the detail level, better comparisons of capabilities so that we can synergize. That is important, and that's underway, and will have some, I think, very productive downstream implications. In terms of making those sort of macro decisions about capabilities, there's an established process between the Joint Requirements Oversight Council and DOD's resource allocation process, where we all build, the services all build their individual programs, as you know, and before those programs get turned into the DOD program and the president's budget, there's a pretty close head-to-head comparison of what capabilities each of the service brings to the table. And so the short answer is yes, those trade-offs were looked at, and I think that will only get better as we continue to find ways to connect earlier in the process. And not so much at the macro level, although we can't stop connecting at the macro level.
So, General, we very much want to thank you both for joining us today, setting the scene for the following panels. We couldn't have done a better job, and more importantly, just for your service to the nation. Please join me around.
Thank you. My pleasure.